Welcome back, everybody. We're talking with Christopher Bolin about solving 9/11 and his upcoming event here in Sweden. And then we're going to get into more here a little bit later on the cover-up itself, the people involved and how this plays into it in the geopolitical sense. But I wanted to ask you a little bit more just about this kind of event in Sweden, I guess, because there's I'm sure if you're you know, familiar with the political correctness that we have in Sweden and everything else. And I don't think that anyone who would attend the event itself would be within this bracket. But if the media in Sweden would handle this subject every time they do, and specifically with the perspective that you have, Christopher, I think, unfortunately, right away, the mudslinging would begin. You'd probably would be called an anti-Semite and everything else, just because you're talking about the Mossad and Israel's involvement and everything else. How would you tackle that if someone, like, you know, charged you with those accusations, Christopher?
Well, you have to always, you know, when people charge you with any sort of accusation of any sort, you have to fight it. So far in Scandinavia, though, the mainstream media has really ignored me. I have contacted the media here in Sweden, and even, you know, some of the big talk shows in Norway and things like that, Skavlan or something like that, that fella. But I've gotten no responses from them, which doesn't surprise me. But that is concerning, because when the media is avoiding a subject of this importance, it means that they're either self-censoring themselves, or they're controlled by somebody who's censoring them outright. And, you know, I like the fact that at least Carl Bildt stands up for the freedom of expression and the freedom of journalists in Scandinavia. And that's why I felt good about coming here in 2009. But then I saw how, I did see how, you know, the Assange case has been treated here, for example.
And I saw
how the Estonia cover-up was, you know, a similar event when Estonia sank in off the coast of Sweden back in 1994.
And by the way, Christopher, I just want to mention, you wrote an excellent article on that I urge everyone to go and read if you want to find out more about what happened to the Estonia and everything else. You have it on your website. I'm going to link that up for people. It's really good stuff. So, yeah, but please go ahead.
I lived in Scandinavia. I lived in Sweden then when that the day that boat sank, I came here that day. And after my wife's former previous husband died on that ship.
Oh, wow.
And so we've been involved in that truth-seeking of the Estonia catastrophe since 1994. And I have to say that, you know, that was my introduction to how cover-ups are done by the media and governments in democratic countries.
Yeah.
You know, Sweden is a democratic state, and Sweden does have a free media and freedom of speech and all that.
I wouldn't say that. Sorry to interrupt again, Christopher, but I have to mention, I mean, the media in Scandinavia is state-subsidized. The state, I mean, practically owns the press, and I believe that that's one of the reasons why certain topics are basically off the books. I mean, they don't talk about mass immigration. They don't talk about 9/11. They don't talk about anything which is within the sphere of political correctness, if you will, or outside of that sphere, rather, which I think is really concerning. I mean, we've had people, you know, immigrants even within Sweden talking about that it's getting to such a bad state because there's no public dialogue about these things. So now, instead, the media, when the state turned their back on these problems, that's going to bloom even more, you know, out on the streets in Sweden, which is causing a lot of problems. So I'm very critical of the so-called free press that exists in Sweden. I don't see it that way at all, you know?
No, but then, I mean, you know, you have your website, for example, and I think your website gets more readers than most newspapers in Sweden. So, you know, there is the alternative media.
Sure.
There are people like you. There are some other outspoken Scandinavians, I think in Scandinavia in general, there's a sense of fairness, and people believe in the ideals of democracy and free speech, and so as long as they have those values, you know, people like yourself will find a way to reach them. This is like I said, this is the first time I'm taking the solving 9/11 information to the public in Scandinavia, and I'll see how it goes. But like I said, the mass media or the newspapers and the Swedish radio and TV have not responded to my my press releases.
Yeah, I'm not surprised about that, and I hope, of course, to a certain extent, it's always good to get publicity. But to a certain another side of me is like, I just hope they do stay away, and that the people who are interested and want to find out about it can actually go there in peace, if you will, to a certain extent, and get the experience that they want, and get the research and the material, if you will, from you as well. But maybe we can return to that a little bit later. We'll see if that fits into it. But let's go back over to what we talked about previously, and maybe we can talk about the international media a little bit. I mean, we have to get into things like the U.S.-Israeli relations, you know, AIPAC, and how you see your home country, the U.S., being controlled on the level of foreign policy by basically Israel at this stage. I mean, that's not a big secret. I mean, that people know about that. They talk about that. The relations have to be in a certain way for politicians to get in place when it comes to the question of Israeli relations and everything else. So how much controlled is the U.S. and the U.S. foreign policy by, you know, outside forces, if you will, Christopher?
Yes, it's gangsterism at its worst. This Zionist gang, which is funded, you know, very much by people like the Rothschilds in Britain, and the big Zionist capital people like Bronfman, and well, there's many of them across the United States, and there is this gangster class, you would call it, in the Zionist movement. There's a gangster class. Which has been there from the very beginning. If people read, you know, the history of Israel, they see how the people like Meir Lansky and the big Zionists, the big Jewish gangsters of the 30s and the 20s in the United States, in Chicago and places like that, how they were very much involved in smuggling weapons to the state, to the Jewish fighters in Palestine, and then to the state of Israel. And this connection between the Israeli weapons dealers, smugglers, people like former Mayor Kolick, Teddy Kolick, another Rothschild son. His father was the director of the Rothschild Bank in Vienna. And people like Shimon Peres and their connection to the gangsters of Chicago, New York, Las Vegas, and Hollywood. They have a interlocking grip on the foreign policy in the United States, on the political class in the United States, on what is taught in universities, what is considered politically correct at the university level, what people learn. You know, America, the United States of America, is a strange place where the right-wing president or prime minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, comes and gives a speech before the joint session of Congress. And the Congress, the United States Congress, gets up and down 29 times like trained seals, applauding this man. This man who is, you know, responsible, at least morally, for what happened on 9/11. I won't blame him. You know, I won't come out and say that I have evidence he did it. But he's the kind of guy, on 9/11, he told the New York Times when he was asked, "What does 9/11 mean for Israel and the United States?" He said, "It's very good."
Yeah.
He said this, you know, before the smoke had cleared. He said, "It's very good." Well, he said, "Well, it's not very good, but it'll help relations. You know, it'll show the Americans that, you know, you're on our side now. You're victims like we are."
That's a good point, Christopher. I just want to talk a little bit more about that. Because what I've seen as well is that it seems like the Middle East conflict is something that had been exported, if you will, to the you know, far corners of the world, that everyone is to be drawn into this conflict, and every day on the news it's about this, that. I mean, even in Sweden there's like, you know, less local news about what really is happening on the streets, how things are going. But it's really focused on the Middle Eastern conflict. It seems like this has been the new kind of the plight of our times, and that's what everyone is supposed to be involved and interested in and have an opinion about, and we should have a are you with Team A or Team B? And we're going to see how this fight, you know, it's theatrics to me, right?
Yeah, And Netanyahu is the one who wrote the script. I mean, he was writing these, in 1979, or 77, he created an institute called the Netanyahu Institute on Terrorism. And it's a terrorism institute, and they had their first big shindig in 1979, and pop-up George Bush was there, and a lot of other people were there. And what they wanted to do is they wanted to basically create terrorism as the new enemy. And they wanted to create a situation where there would be a war against terrorism, and all of the democracies of the West would coalesce behind this coalition and fight this war. And this is exactly what we have. So you see, for Benjamin Netanyahu, this is the answer to his prayer. This is what he was always preaching for, what he always hoped for. So when I say that he's the godfather of 9/11, I mean it. I think that they actually put Shimon Peres is in there too, and so is a lot of other Israelis. And they have their helpers in New York and Montreal and London, the people who support them and finance them. And you know what? In the United States, you talk about the control of the Swedish media. In the United States, in the last 20 years or so, the media has gotten so combined into so few hands that today it's like five or six big media companies own virtually all the newspapers and radio and television stations in the United States of America.
Yeah.
So you're not getting any sort of spectrum of views like you might get in Mexico, for example. In America, you get the same thing whether you're reading in Omaha or Ontario. You read the same stuff in the paper. You get the same point of view, and it is frightening. You know, it is frighteningly pro-war. Very aggressive.
Yeah.
And you know, Fox News, where it's gone from reporting to outright, almost like mental torture. You will either people like that Bill O'Reilly say, if you don't believe what I say, if you don't support the war, then you're not an American, or they have this kind of psychological terrorism. So the hapless viewer at home in Omaha, they wind up supporting everything that Fox News stands for. And Fox News is run by the Murdoch. He's a criminal. I mean, he's been on trial. He hasn't been found guilty. But my God, he's been hacking into people's phones and emails and everything long before the NSA was doing it.
And what I find funny as well is that these days, the so-called liberal media in the U.S. as well, the flip side spectrum of that with MSNBC and CNN as well, they're exactly the same when it comes down to the points of the war policies and everything else. They're right there backing them up, and there's no diversity, as you said. There's no spectrum whatsoever in that. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, well, that's the thing, is that in America, war has always been big business. But the thing is that these companies that are profiting from the war in Afghanistan and Iraq and the whole war on terror, you know, many of these companies are owned by Zionist families who are part of that gangster class I was talking about a minute ago, like the Crown family of Chicago. They control General Dynamics. You know, this is a family who was very much involved in the cover-up of the murder of John F. Kennedy, very much involved in the cover-up of what happened on 9/11, and very much involved in getting Obama into the White House. So it's like you have these families who are basically war profiteers who get, you know, billions and billions of dollars from the Federal Treasury every year, who play huge roles in the media and in politics in America. And that's what we would face today. And it's like Hollywood is a completely a Zionist controlled operation, has been for a long time. So the American people are living like in a kind of like a Zionist circus, and all the acts are put on by the same circus. So, you know, whether it's the lion act or the trapeze artist or whatever, it's all part of the same circus. And so they wind up coming away with basically the same idea.
You know, we have multiple, I think at least, agendas playing into each other at the same time. You have mutual mm-hmm. beneficial relationships of for example, why mm-hmm. there would be an interest in expanding the war in Afghanistan, in Iraq, eventually taking it into Syria and Iran as well. And you have you know, the business side of oil politics involved in that, which is also beneficial of that. You have the wars, the arms dealers and the trade and the, mm-hmm. the exporting and importing of weapons and everything there. Then you have a geopolitical advantage from the point of view of Israeli foreign policy and everything else. So to me, it seems we have a number of interlocking relationships that are mutually beneficial and they decide, you know, this is just the way to go. And everyone who have agreed within this network, of course, might not be in full understanding of why the other part is part of it or whatnot. But it seems to me that you've gotten this very mutual beneficial cooperation within that. Do you think that that's a possibility of what we're looking at as well, Christopher?
Yeah, that's very true what you say. But then there is this very high level financial class, like when we talk about House of Rothschild, for example, which is involved in strategic ownership of minerals really strategic. They want to control, for example, as much gold production, as much oil production, as much gas production, you know, what have you. And the Middle East being, very rich with oil, gas, and other minerals, has long been a place where they have had their focus. I mean, the Rothschilds were involved in creating the State of Israel in the very first place because they wanted to protect the Suez Canal, which they owned, for their global trade to India and things like that. So here again, they want very much to control the assets of Russia, which they have temporarily lost hold of, and they want to control the assets of Iran and the Caspian Sea, and so there's this whole geopolitical game being fought. So who will control this? So they foment, like you said, they foment revolutions or quasi revolutions or real revolutions, but they foment them, like what we see today in Ukraine. What's happening in Syria, and whole countries are devastated, like Syria are completely devastated by this. There's the United States is playing a very big role in that. They're playing a big role in the Ukrainian revolution, just like they played in the revolution in Georgia and everywhere else, because they want to, these people, like the Kagan family I was talking about before, they want to take as much real estate away from the sphere of influence of Russia and Iran. I mean, those are their two big enemies, Iran and Russia.
Now, what do you think about some of the other people here that were, if we're on the topic of Russia a little bit, because it was, I think there have been very interesting developments in Russia with Putin and the way that he seemed to have booted out some of the former oligarchs as well. You know, you had Mikhail Khodorkovsky, you had the other, I forget the name of him right now, but he was basically the one who was betting on Putin at the time, and the claim is that he basically lost, you know, control of him, and he had to. I'll think about the name here in a minute; it'll come to me. But there are a lot of people who see that something else have occurred in Russia, while other people say no, they're completely, you know, Zionist controlled as well. And but what's your opinion on that? Where is Russia in all of this? Do you think?
When he released Khodorkovsky before the Olympics, that was a smart move because he wanted to remove as many bones of contention before the Olympics. So that was a smart thing to do. I mean, that guy had spent 10 years in jail for his crimes. But I think that the degree of Jewish and Zionist influence in Russia is very, very big because, I mean, you have to understand this is where these people come from. The Jews of Eastern Europe are coming from the Pale of Settlement, which was formerly Western Russia, and you know this is where they're from, and they have a lot of people in those countries, so that they still have a lot of influence. But you know, Putin was very, very foxy, very clever, and he outmaneuvered them and got a lot of the assets that they had stolen, you know, return to the state of Russia, which is definitely good because, where Boris Yeltsin was taking Russia was into this third world status. There would not be a Olympic Games in Sochi if Boris Yeltsin had stayed in power and lived longer.
Yep.
And so, I mean, Putin has done, good things for Russia in that regard. By getting the Zionists on these Israeli oligarchs, at least into some degree of containment, I think that he did a good thing.
And do you think that that's also one of the reasons why the West is so incredibly, you know, in a position where they constantly are trying to demonize Russia? The guy I was thinking about by is Boris Berezovsky, and he was the one who was kind of in the transition phase before Putin got in, and allegedly again. Then I mean, Putin is an ex-KGB agent, I believe, and he seemed to have lost control. He was booted out and basically went to in exile, flying back and forth between, you know, London and Tel Aviv, I think, Berezovsky, and eventually he was killed in a very interesting, you know, case as well. Did you follow up what might have actually happened to him?
I the thing about what Berezovsky is that he was involved in the murder of Litvinenko, the former KGB agent or whatever, who died of that polonium poisoning.
Yeah.
And he had been in Berezovsky's house drinking tea, and that room where he had been drinking tea tested positive for polonium and all that kind of stuff, you know. So there was another false flag. That was a false flag murder. They wanted to pin the blame on Putin and the Russian security service, when in fact it looks like it was an Israeli operation, just like they killed Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat was killed by polonium in the same way, and they that's now come out. You know, that's very clear that polonium was used to kill Arafat, and polonium was used to kill probably by Berezovsky, giving him a poison cup of tea or a poison drink to this Litvinenko guy. So that's also why they're trying to denigrate these Olympics, because they really continue this constant warfare against Russia and against Putin. You know, in the old days, in the Greek times, when the Olympics began, when the Olympics were being held, the various countries would stop fighting, and they'd come to the Olympics, and they would stop fighting. But in this case, they're not doing that. But you know, the United States is very, very irritated by the Snowden affair, because Russia's protecting Snowden, giving him asylum. And Snowden has really embarrassed the U.S. government and NSA with their spying tactics.
Exactly. Another case as well involved in this, for another person, I should say, is Alexander Goldfarb. He has been running a New York-based organization called the International Foundation for Civil Liberties. He's gotten a lot of money from George Soros, among others, and he's been part of you know, funding things like the Orange Revolution in Ukraine. I think he spent nearly $40 million, you know, US dollars on this particular way as well. And there was, I think that one of the reasons here has been to try to kind of turn the former satellite states of Russia against Russia, to kind of put pressure on them to take control over them through NGOs, and of course, you know, constantly beating the drum of, oh, it's for, you know, democracy and civil liberties and everything else. But that's just a facade. That's just a front of trying to gain control and put the right people in place in these countries so that every one of them will turn against Russia, right? Have you learned more about that?
Exactly. You know, we saw it right away in the Baltic republics of Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and then Georgia. And all around in the former Warsaw Pact and the former Soviet Union, the United States and its allies are doing everything they can to take control and to put in pro-Western regimes in these countries. And this is often to the detriment of the country.
Yeah.
You take, for example, Estonia. Estonia historically has survived as the trading ground between Germany and Scandinavia and Russia. But if you poison the relationship between Estonia and Russia, then that country becomes dependent on largesse from the United States and the West. Well, that largesse is not always forthcoming, and that's not a very good business plan. So they hurt themselves. And the same thing down there in Georgia, you know, that the Georgian president, the young Georgian president who decided to wage war in Ossetia a couple of years ago, and to try and take that part of that region back into Georgian sovereignty, you know, he lost, and Russia helped, you know, stood up for the accession. But I mean, this is the kind of game that they're playing. And like, you know, this Victoria Nuland, the one that was swearing about the European Union the other day, she goes out there and she's supporting these people in Ukraine, these people who are who are trying to get Ukraine into the European Union. Well, you know, you have to ask yourself, is the European Union really going to be good for the people of Ukraine?
No.
Is it better for the Ukraine? No. I mean, the Ukrainian people are kindred, very closely related to their Slavic brothers in Russia. And, you know, I don't know but they're playing a very dangerous game when they start fomenting these revolutions in places like Kiev, because, I mean, they can get very bloody, and they can get very, look what happened to Syria. I mean, that's completely irresponsible. What Saudi Arabia and Qatar and the United States and the English countries have done in Syria, I mean, that's criminal.
Yeah, I mean, the people, some analysts called it basically the color revolution 2.0, first, you know, but in the Middle Eastern and North African countries. And again, we see the same line of thinking, that on the surface, to get people riled up, you hammer on the drum of this is for democracy, civil liberties, freedom, blah, blah, blah. But then behind the scenes, it's all about switching the guard, getting the right people in place so that they can align themselves according to the bigger global geopolitical chess game, right?
And so they can extract the assets, so they can extract the mineral assets. Like, you know, the first, when they finally got the control of Iraq, the very first tanker that was filled up with oil there was a British Petroleum, BP tanker.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, for the entire time that the United States ran that Coalition Provisional Authority, I think it was called, under Jerry Bremer Lewis, who worked for Marsh & McLennan, that company where the first plane struck, when he was from Kissinger Associates, but when that man was running Iraq, for the whole time he was running Iraq, they did not measure the amount of oil that was being exported. Can you believe it?
Hmm.
They did not measure. They did not measure how much was being offloaded into these British Petroleum tankers and Chevron, all those guys who filled up with oil.
Hmm.
So it's just basically exploitation of their resources. And, you know, it's the same thing as in Afghanistan is just chock full of minerals, valuable minerals, gas, oil, but also the strategic pipelines they need to build across that country, because they're very much struggling to keep Iran from being the dominant country in that region. So they're fighting a war against Iran. So that's why they're fighting in Syria, because Syria is Iran's closest ally to the West. If they can destroy the integrity of the Syrian government, then they figure they're one step closer to Tehran.
Indeed.
I mean, these people, this is the Zionist war agenda. And when we talk about the Zionist war agenda, what they want to do is that they want to control these countries so they can plunder their mineral resources. I mean, that's what they do. That's what they do in Canada. That's what they do in America. That's what they do everywhere they go. In Mali, they have gold mines down in Mali. Why do you think the French troops are in Mali? They don't care about North Mali or South Mali. They care about the gold mines in Mali. And everywhere you go. There's the oil of Libya. There's the oil of Iraq. It's just looting the planet, plundering the planet. And you see, this criminal enterprise, this criminal network, is like an iceberg. And the most conspicuous tip of that iceberg is 9/11, the crime of 9/11. And that's why I'm so persistent about this and working on it. You know, I worked on it for so long, is because we have to persevere, and we have to be very tenacious in trying to solve 9/11 and getting the guilty held accountable, because that is their Achilles heel. You know, they can be taken to court for what they did or didn't do about 9/11, for the crimes they committed in 9/11, the covering up of 9/11. And there we see that they're all lined up in a row. The owners of the media, the Rothschild, you know, funded media people, like Murdoch, and they all support the official version of 9/11. They all support the wars. They all support the Zionist war agenda. But this Zionist war agenda is ruining the planet. You know, if we want to survive on this planet, we have to stop this war agenda. And to stop the war agenda, we have to, you know, we have to find the guilty people from 9/11 and prosecute them.
Yeah, and again, everything of this is done with the aid of military, it's done with the aid of government, is done through the, I mean, look at America, over 50% of the taxes goes to fund the war, and that's become like the new and only almost standing industry these days. I mean, people and Americans, they go up and join the military to be able to, you know, pay off their student loans or, you know, get ahead financially in some way, and it's become like the lifeblood of this. And that has to be, that stream of income and where the money goes, that has to be cut off as well in this regard, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, it's that, you know, military industrial complex that Eisenhower warned the American people about back in 1959. They're the ones who killed Kennedy, you know, so they could get the Vietnam War. The whole time that I grew up in the United States was at war with in Vietnam. Another war nobody understood. What are we doing there? What's the point? What's the purpose? You know, the whole country was torn between the war, against the war, for the war. And now, again, we have the same thing, you know, the endless glorification of the wars and the films and the, you know, like the military is such a dominant force in U.S. culture today. I find it almost impossible to believe, because when I grew up in the United States in the 60s and 70s, there was a strong resistance to war. There was this idea that the war in Vietnam was wrong, that it was bad for our democracy and bad for our republic, and there was a very healthy, you know, anti-war movement. But that anti-war movement doesn't seem to exist anymore, you know, and that's what I can't figure out. If, for example, this Occupy Wall Street movement, if they had been, you know, serious if they really were serious about what they were trying to do, they should have articulated what they wanted. And one of the things they should have articulated is that they should have demanded a proper investigation of 9/11 and prosecution of the guilty. Because that is the, like I said, that is the seminal event that has taken us down this nasty road of war and financial defraud, people being defrauded on a huge scale. You know, like I said, the man who owned the building, the man who owned the computer room where the first plane went in, was also the CEO of AIG, the company that was bailed out in the bailout of 2008-2009. So, I mean, it's like these things are all connected.
Yeah.
So, like I'm saying, if we want to uproot this criminal enterprise, network, syndicate that has taken control of our government and other governments, we have to start by prosecuting the crimes that we can prosecute them on. And 9/11 is the most egregious atrocity. This is where everybody can agree. You know, on 9/11, in those towers, when the plane hit the South Tower, it hit about the 82nd floor. And what we saw from that 82nd floor, before, about 10 minutes before the building fell, this molten iron began falling off. White hot molten iron started falling off the floor in large amounts. I mean, large amounts of like a waterfall of, you know, from a volcano, except it was white hot. That means that the temperature on that floor was at least 1,200 degrees Celsius. That means that the people above that floor, for the 30 floors above that floor, they were being cooked in a sauna hotter than any sauna you've ever been in. And that's why so many people chose to jump, because they didn't want to be cooked to death. They couldn't stand it anymore. You know, and then people have to remember that the doors to the roof were locked. I mean, what kind of evacuation plan did Larry Silverstein have for these people? The doors to the roof were locked, which prevented any sort of helicopter evacuation. So, I mean, we're talking about very, very evil people who plotted 9/11. They don't deserve any sympathy from us whatsoever, regardless of their race, their religion, or sexual identity. You know, these people have to be prosecuted to the nth degree, and we owe that to our history and to our progeny.
What road do you think will be taken down if there is no resistance to their plans, and how far and wide? Let's say, if we just for a moment kind of speculate here a little bit and talk about their dream world of how things would be organized and look, what do you think we're looking at if that's the case?
War. I mean, look at the Kagans. Look at these people who wrote the Project for the New American Century, the people who brought us Iraq and brought us Afghanistan. They just want war, because from the war that they create the chaos, they can then extract the benefit. They can create their order and extract benefit. These are the people, these are the same kind of people who brought the mass death in the Soviet Union. And they have now nuclear-tipped arsenals at their disposal. They have the state of Israel. Israel has not only submarines, it has nuclear missiles, and, you know, there's no telling what these people will do. But they thrive on war, because war means profits for the companies that they own that make the weapons. It means that the profits from the interest that the governments have to pay to borrow the money to fight the wars, like the United States government. And it means that they then reap the spoils from the minerals and from the looting of the countries that they overthrow. So it's global war. That's why I call it the Zionist war agenda. It's just war, war, war. And we have to stop that. You know, we have to come to our senses. We have to say that, you know, we've been duped, we've been deceived, but we want a better future for our children than war.
Indeed. Now, tell us what happened to you. You flew over to England recently. You were going to do a talk on a show there. You were basically blocked and sent back to Sweden again. What happened there and why?
Yeah, Ken O'Keefe, he's an American, a former American veteran of the war in Iraq, the first war, and he was on the flotilla to Gaza, and he was involved there, and he actually was had captured a couple of the Israeli soldiers, and the Israelis didn't take very kindly to that. So when they got him back to Israel, they roughed him up a lot and bloodied his face. And he came out of the airport when he was returned from Israel with his face all bloody. That's when I first heard about him. And there were a lot of Swedes on that, actually. Henning Montell was on there and a few other journalists. Mm-hmm. But in any case, he invited me to come on. He started a show on this People's Voice TV, which is a David Icke production over there in Britain, in London, in Wembley. And I was, I had helped him with the... I helped him with a script for his 9/11 program, which was to be his first program. And I checked it for accuracy and made a few corrections and added a few things. And then he invited me to come and, you know, be on the show. So I thought, well, this is a good opportunity to go over there. And I certainly wanted this worthwhile endeavor to support. So I went over there, and I was stopped at passport control, because it's not in the European Union Schengen zone agreement area. So you have to go through passport control, customs. And the lady asked me a lot of questions about how did I know Mr. O'Keefe, and how had I been in communication with him before, and all that kind of stuff. And I told her everything, what I was going to do, what the plans were. I was going to stay at his house, and I was supposed to go to Paddington and give him a call, and he'd come pick me up. She didn't like that. And I gave her the phone number for Ken O'Keefe so she can go call and confirm this all. And she didn't come back. And they had me, they put me in a little detention area, and I had to sit there. And it went on and on and on. Then a Metro policeman came, and plainclothesman interviewed me for a while. Then they put me in a detention cell. And then they did an interview with me at 8 o'clock at night. So they had from 1 o'clock in the afternoon when I was first detained until 8 o'clock at night, they had not told me any reason why I was being detained. But then at 8 o'clock at night, they did an interrogation where each page was written down, and I had to sign each page as we completed it. And in that, they asked me if I had any convictions in the United States of America. And I told them that I had 2 misdemeanor accounts based on the undercover, that stemmed from the undercover police attack at my house in 2006. And then an hour later, she came back, and based on that, what I had told about those 2 misdemeanors in Chicago, she said that I was a threat to British public security, something like that, and I was then being sent back to Sweden on the next flight the next day. I thought it was very odd that they were doing this, but then I understand that, you know, the city of London is the hinterland of Palestine, of Israel. You know, Israel was created in London, and Israel is fostered in London, and, you know, the Rothschilds in the city of London control the state of Israel. So, like people say, if the official version were correct, they would not have locked me out of Britain. But they apparently were sending me a message, and they didn't want me speaking on the TV or whatever with Ken O'Keefe. So we did the show anyway, and I called in just like I'm doing now to you, and it worked out very well, actually.
Do you think it would have turned out different if you just said that you were going to visit a friend, or do you think that you were singled out because of something that they knew about you from beforehand?
Well, you know, we have to understand that nowadays the country where you're flying to, they know that you're on the plane as soon as you make your ticket. And I was flying on British Airways. So as soon as I had bought my ticket and confirmed my ticket on British Airways, from Sweden, the authorities in Britain knew. And they have, you know, like the NSA, they have all kinds of lists of people who are suspect or anti-war. You know how the United States, for example, didn't let Cat Stevens, Yusuf Islam.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't let him into the United States a few years ago. He was flying over there, and they even pulled the plane down in Bangor, Maine, and sent him back to England because he's a peace guy, or he had contributed to some Islamic society, Muslim society. So what? Some charity. But I think that they knew that I was coming and didn't want me to come, and perhaps wanted to just give me some grief and make me think that I'm persona non grata in Britain. And so they did that. I don't know what games they're playing, but I told that policeman from the Metro Police, I said, you know, Ken O'Keefe and myself, we're not the bad guys. You know, we're patriotic people. We believe in fairness, and we believe in good things. We're not the bad guy here, because they want to make us feel like we somehow are doing the wrong thing by pointing out these big crimes, by pointing out the tremendous injustices, you know, we see around us, that somehow we shouldn't be doing that. I mean, if we don't do that, if we ignore the injustice in this world, and if we let such travesties of injustice or of justice go by, what is there to live for?
What do you make of what's going to go down here, geopolitically speaking, in the next, I don't know, 5-10 years? It seems to me, though, that the few tactics that they did try in terms of, putting blame on Iran and trying to get more and more into Syria, it's been kind of somewhat thwarted here and there. So in certain situations, it hasn't, I think, unfolded in the way that they expected it to. And as we've seen, they've basically changed tactics. For example, what we saw in Libya, I mean, how many years ago is that now? 4 or 5 years ago? I can't recall, but nonetheless, maybe a little bit less. That tactic was basically emulated in a completely, you know, different way in some of the other Middle Eastern countries, where they, as I said before, they opted for the kind of, all right, let's use the people themselves to kind of detopple their regimes and we do it from the inside kind of thing with social media and propaganda and everything else. So, but even the latest couple of attempts of that have seemed to kind of stalled a little bit. So what do you think their next plan is to kind of move ahead as they see fit in the world?
Well, that's a big question. I don't know what they plan to do, but I do know that it's nothing good. Nothing good will come from these people. Nothing good will come from these characters who pulled off 9/11 and the people who brought us into Iraq and Afghanistan and the people who are running the U.S. government today. Nothing good will come out of this criminal network. It's a criminal gang. You know, that's who it is. Obama is not a rightful president. We don't have proper elections in the United States, so we wind up with this appointed officials, if you will. And we don't have a democracy in America. So they, but the main field of their game is the United States of America. Because that is the biggest market, and that is the place where they have the power, and they want to use the power of the U.S. military and the U.S. nation. They're like it's like a parasite. They want to control the host, which is the United States, to do what they want to do. They want to wage war, and so they drag us into this country and that country. So the real thing is that, how will they be able, will they continue to be successful in deceiving the American people? That's where they're failing. You know, not only my work about September 11th, but this whole awareness of how we have been deceived in the past and how they used deception to enslave us, so that we now, there are warnings when there's some sort of military operation or some drill going to be conducted in the Persian Gulf. We put up warning flags. Look out, something could happen here. They might want to create a false flag terror event so they could start a war with Iran, for example. Now, that awareness and the internet has helped us a great deal, I think, in preventing some of these conspiracies that they had planned. And as you say, their strategy to overthrow the government of Syria has failed. I mean, it's been a terrible, terrible catastrophe for the Syrian people. But they have not succeeded in putting their you know chosen few in power in Syria. That hasn't succeeded yet. That's an ongoing thing. And everywhere they have gone, they've made a mess. They've made a mess, or the country has wound up going retrograde, like in Egypt. Now Egypt is back in the hands of the military, and it's no better off than it was in the beginning. Libya is a catastrophe.
Yeah.
Everywhere they go, Afghanistan is a catastrophe. Iraq's a catastrophe. I mean, in Iraq, 1,000 civilians are killed every month. I mean, they were so much better off under Saddam Hussein. People probably pray, they wish that Saddam Hussein was back. But, you know, we upset the entire balance of power in those countries, and we installed, you know, some quisling, and now the countries are just bleeding through it all.
And again, just this basic perception that people have to understand is that when they have a statement officially, you know, in the media and the press that, okay, we're going to move into the country to help them. We're going to, you know, stabilize things. We're going to make it better. We're going to, you know, do this, that, whatever. That's not the point. The point is the complete opposite, to create chaos, to create conditions of complete, you know, depravity, to ravage the country economically, set up central banks and do all these things that the rest of the world has. And at the same time, it's kind of a, all right, we're going to bring you the promises of Western democracy, you know, because that's the greatest champion of everything that we have, right? So it's our duty to export this to the rest of the world, even though they haven't asked for it or they have something else going on in the country. So it's become the job of the Western world with America at the tip, and as you said, then Israel at the head of this beast, if you will, to try to go into these countries and completely reform them, homogenize the world into a packet of globalism, which will work for everyone. But of course, as usual, in these processes, when they have these grand plans in place, millions of people are going to be displaced. Millions of people are going to be damaged and hurt, and maybe even, you know, killed and murdered in the process, as we've seen when the British, you know, carved up India and Pakistan back in the early, you know, 1900s. I think over a million people died just because of the chaos and the displacement and everything else, you know. So they're trying to restore order to something that doesn't need it, really, and in the process create chaos. So that's what people have to understand, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, that's their strategy is also by creating chaos, they can then extract from that chaos the order that they want.
Yeah,
they can change things, and you know that's the thing is that like when I saw the Norwegians were involved in active combat in Afghanistan, I contacted the Norwegian government and asked them. I said, I thought that you were building schools over there. I thought you were doing charitable, you know, good doings, and now I read that you're fighting, and your guys are shooting at Afghan people from like 2 miles away, and finding it thoroughly enjoyable to kill Afghan people. I said, what's going on here? Are you fighting a war? Are you building schools? And you know, of course, the Norwegian government didn't really want to respond to any of my questions. But you know, I've seen here in my little housing area here, there was a former soldier from Afghanistan, a Swedish soldier who'd been in Afghanistan. And apparently he must have said something to somebody, or they realized that he was going to become a little bit dangerous. And one day the police came and took him away, and we have never seen him again. Hmm. So he went to a psychological, he went sent to a psychological hospital. He was a former elite soldier in Sweden because, in Afghanistan, because these soldiers that go there, they might feel like they're Rambo and they're invulnerable and all that, but when they wind up killing people, especially when they commit unjustified killings of people, they do immense damage to their soul. And they often then, you know, become crazy and life becomes unbearable for them. So this is a really terrible thing. We've created this class of monsters. Okay, it's much smaller in Sweden and Norway, but in the United States, we have so many people who are coming back from these wars who have done really terrible things to the Afghan people or to the Iraqi people. And, you know, they have health problems. They have been exposed to depleted uranium. And then on top of that, they have this guilty conscience of what they've done and what they've seen. You know, it's just really, we're creating really awful societies for ourselves.
Yeah, I know. And beginning to address the problem, that's the first thing we need to do. So I want to just a couple of things here then before we begin to wrap things up for this time, Christopher. Let me mention again then the upcoming event here in Sweden. If you want to attend that, it's in Jönköping. mid-south Sweden. It's on February 24th, and we're going to have the links up to that, of course, if you're interested and want to find out more about that. Then you have the book as well that we've been talking about, Solving 9/11, and there's many more components to what's in your book, mm-hmm. Christopher, than we've managed to address and talk about here today. We've focused on, you know, a little bit of the bigger agenda as well, mm-hmm. but you have a lot more details in the book than that. But please let us know if there's anything else you'd like to give out or something else you have upcoming that you'd like to mention, and give us your website again then before we wrap things up here, Christopher.
Sure. My website is bolin.com. That's BOLLYN.com. And as you said, the set of books is called Solving 9/11. The first book is Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. And the second book is the larger book. It's the 135 articles that I've written about, and that's called Solving 9/11, The Original Articles. And that's really essential for the person who's really studying the history of 9/11, because the detailed information is in that Original Articles book. And if you read that, those articles are chronological, starting from September 2001. And if you read through that chronologically, you can see how all this evidence and all this analysis developed, and how it falls into place and leads one to this conclusion that this was a giant Zionist conspiracy to kickstart this war agenda, which we now find ourselves, you know, deeply immersed in.
All right. Thanks, Christopher, for coming on with us today. We appreciate your time, and thanks for sharing your perspective and your research with us. I hope we can have you back again in the future and continue our conversation. But in the meantime, we say thanks and have a good time in Jönköping, and I hope a lot of people come by us and watch it as well.
Thank you, Henrik. It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Okay, that concludes our program for today. We have a lot more coming, of course, with Barbara Peterson, Karen Hudis, Konpop Yuyen, David Icke, Ulla Demegård, Brian Forrester, and L.A. Marzulli as well, just to mention a few. But we'll be back in just a few days. In the meantime, stay tuned to our websites and follow our news feed as well. A big thanks to our members, as always, and to the crew. Have a good night or evening. We'll talk to you again soon. Stay well.